Welcome to the SMART OB-Med curriculum. Social media for advancing residency training in obstetric medicine. We here present to you a national collaboration between the Universities of Ottawa and Alberta. This research project has been generously funded by the Department of Medicine at the Montfort Hospital, empowering future physicians in the care of medically complex pregnancies. We hope you will enjoy it.
Welcome to the Advanced Learner Series. My name is Sarah Elias. I'm one of the fifth-year General Internal Medicine Fellows, and we have the pleasure of having Dr. Janine Malcolm and Dr. Erin Keeley here with us today. Dr. Janine Malcolm is an endocrinologist and associate professor and clinical investigator in the Department of Medicine at the University of Ottawa. She is Vice Chair for Quality and Patient Safety and Director of Equity, Diversity, Inclusion, and Accessibility. She is a leading expert in the care of patients with diabetes and pregnancy, and has contributed nationally as a member of the expert committee for the 2018 Diabetes Canada Practice Guideline, amongst many other accomplishments. In her spare time, Dr. Malcolm can be found on her Peloton or planning her next adventure abroad. Dr. Malcolm, what's your favorite ride on the Peloton?
Oh boy. So I like the hit and hill rides on the Peloton. They are a really good workout.
A good challenge.
They're a good challenge.
Dr. Erin Keeley is an endocrinologist at the Ottawa Hospital and full professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Ottawa. She is a former president of the North American Society of Obstetric Medicine, past chair of the Canadian Diabetes and Pregnancy Interest Group, and co-author of the Diabetes Canada Diabetes and Pregnancy Clinical Practice Guidelines. In recognition of her contribution to the medical care of pregnant women, she received the North American Society of Obstetric Medicine Lifetime Achievement Award in 2019. In her spare time, Dr. Keeley can be found on the golf course trying to improve her score or enjoying her new role as a grandmother. Dr. Keeley, what's your favorite activity to do with your grandkids?
Right now, it's being at the cottage with them and seeing them enjoy being outside and by the water and on the trampoline. I know you're not supposed to have kids on a trampoline, but it's got a net, it's safe, and they enjoy jumping on it.
So Dr. Malcolm, Dr. Keeley, welcome. So we'll get started with the case. We have a 28-year-old female. She is a G3 T1 A2L1, and she has an unexpected pregnancy. She's currently at 10 weeks plus 5 gestation, and she was actually sent to the emergency room department from the ultrasound department due to findings of a molar pregnancy. She denied any symptoms other than some mild abdominal cramping and some very infrequent mild palpitations. In the emergency department, she is mildly tachycardic at 110, regular. She has a slightly enlarged thyroid, but otherwise her examination is normal. She is afebrile and has a completely normal cardiorespiratory exam. Her TSH was sent, as often done in molar pregnancies, and it was found to be undetectable at less than 0.01. Her T4 was undetectably high, above 100, and her T3 was 45. OB consults endocrinology for management. Their plan is to offer a DNC when deemed clinically stable to do so. Is this molar pregnancy sufficient to really explain the degree of her thyroid function abnormalities?
So when you have someone who presenting a severe thyrotoxicosis in pregnancy, so definitely molar pregnancy can do it. And you can definitely see numbers that are that high. But it is important to think about other things as always. So you do want to think about things like Graves' disease. Probably, you know, a thyroiditis could do it as well. But, you know, usually she probably would have had some other presenting, symptoms. I don't think you can really differentiate between, you know, someone newly presented in Graves versus a molar pregnancy or a combination just based on the thyroid levels alone. But I do think that in this instance, I probably would definitely send a thyroid receptor antibody. I usually do, to make sure you haven't missed anything else.
Just out of curiosity, does the thyroid enlargement tell you anything or pushes you to really?
Because even with Graves, even a very active Graves, you can sometimes have quite a small, firm gland, actually. So you don't necessarily have to have a huge gland. You know, a molar pregnancy, probably the etiology there is your high beta-HCG causing, you know, sort of, you know, expansion of your gland. So I don't really think the exam necessarily may tell you. You know, where the exam may be helpful if a person really does have those Graves signs. So if someone who does come in with a very large goiter, you know, they have a brewery, if they have eye symptoms, then you, definitely your thoughts would go more along the lines of Graves.
Right.
Yeah, I think the other thing that's really important is the history. So if they had any symptoms prior to pregnancy, mm-hmm. Then that, and an autoimmune history or family history would also up my ante for thinking that this isn't a molar pregnancy. And I think it's important you want to exclude other things, even though it's, you know, you think that they're going to have one thing, the molar pregnancy causing all of this, but if there's any inkling either on the physical exam of other autoimmune things or history, then it's important to think more broadly.
Right. How would you go about treating this patient in order to avoid a possible thyroid storm, given that DNC has been recommended by the OB team?
So no matter whether it's a molar pregnancy or another cause, you need to prevent it getting worse during anesthetic. So the risk of the anesthetic and thyroid storm is more release of the thyroid hormone. So in order to prevent that, you need to stop the production of thyroid hormone by giving PTU in this situation, which will also reduce T4 to T3 conversion, and her T4 is remarkably high, and as well as iodine. But you need to give the PTU first, and then give the iodine. And it can be challenging to get the iodine in time. So, and you need to make sure that people understand that this is urgent. The other important thing is a beta blocker if needed, and generally propranolol because of the theoretical T4 to T3 conversion. But you really want to make sure that they have the PTU and the iodine on board prior to anesthetic.
So she goes on and receives propylthiouracil PTU, 500 milligrams times once, followed by 200 milligrams every 8 hours. She then goes on to receive Lugol's iodine solution, and she receives a total of 10 drops, and she's placed on propranolol, 40 milligrams every 8 hours. She's brought to the OR for her DNC 4 hours after the initiation of treatment. Her post-op DNC course is uncomplicated, and she is discharged on PTU 200 milligram every 8 hours and propranolol 40 milligram every 8 hours with close outpatient follow-up. Her TRAb level is sent, given the concern that there might be a concurrent Graves alongside the molar pregnancy, which returns elevated at 24. She returns to clinic with improved values and PTU. However, she developed a new rash for which her family doctor has prescribed a steroid cream. She is therefore switched from PTU to methimazole and stabilizes on methimazole at a dose of 10 milligrams daily. She does not develop any ocular symptoms of Graves, and she returns 6 months later in follow-up and brings up that she might want to get pregnant in the near future. So how would you manage this patient at this time? And how would you counsel her for a future pregnancy, given that it would be potentially risky to have her back on PTU?
Yeah. So I think it depends, but if she's still hyperthyroid and she wants to be pregnant as soon, I probably would not reintroduce PTU if she had a big rash, because, you know, the likelihood that that would probably occur again. And I would not probably want to use methimazole because your risk of congenital malformation is definitely higher with methimazole. So the two options on the table would be either a surgery or radioactive iodine therapy. So, you know, if you're trying to, and I think she should be presented with both, radioactive iodine therapy, you know, again, depending on when she wants to get pregnant, that will make a difference. So, number one, radioactive iodine therapy may take a while for it to work, right, for her to become euthyroid, but you don't want to become pregnant at least within the first 6 months post. There may be also a theoretical risk of maybe increased neonatal graves if you have a slightly increased titer of the you know, thyroid receptor antibody. That could theoretically play a role. And then the other option is surgery. That is, you know, that's immediate. You will cure your hyperthyroidism. You don't have to wait for the radioactive iodine. She is left with a scar. She's on obviously lifetime thyroid hormone replacement therapy. But that would be the other option if she, let's say, wanted to get pregnant earlier or did not want to have the risk of the radioactive iodine therapy.
Right.
The other option would be to continue the methimazole for a year to 18 months. So if this was outside of pregnancy, you would treat her for 18 months, hope that she goes into remission and you can follow her TRABs by going down. So the other option would be to treat her for 12 months, see what happens with her TRAB, see what dose she gets on the methimazole. And then theoretically, you could stop it as soon as she knew she was pregnant and reintroduce it in second trimester if needed. So it is the other option. And you know, congenital anomaly rates with methimazole are 9%, right? So she still has a 90% chance of baby without a congenital anomaly. So I think it's a really hard decision.
Totally.
If it's within that year, because the radioactive iodine for sure increases your TRAb antibodies, so your risk of neonatal graves is higher. You've got to be on the right amount of thyroid hormone before you conceive. So you got to not only have it work, as Jeannie mentioned, it takes time for it to work. And then it takes time to know if they're hypothyroid, and then it takes time to get them on the right amount of T4. And so none of these things are going to happen particularly quickly.
Right.
So you have to try and I think manage expectations,
yeah,
about whether any of those three options. Yeah,
age may come into it too, and then you know, age and how long it may be taken her to get pregnant in the first place. But it is definitely a very challenging conversation and management decision that you really have to embark on with the patient.
And I think the third option that you brought up, Dr. Keeley, is this something that you would consider if the patient was on a lower dose of methimazole only to stop during the first trimester?
Yeah, so she's only been at this 6 months, and it's going to be worse those first few months after pregnancy because her immune system is going to be on fire, so her TRABs are going to go up. Mm-hmm. So Graves will flare. And, you know, will it flare that much if she's, you know, given that her pregnancy terminated early? Well, it'll still flare a bit. And so she hasn't really had a trial on methimazole. So usually, you know, again, it's 12 to 18 months that you're going to see that effect. And usually the dose is going to come down. So she really hasn't been on it long enough to say what dose. So if you got down to 2.5 milligrams every day, which would, you know, not be that uncommon, and had her T4 normal going into pregnancy, then you've got to stop them as soon as pregnant, right? Because it's esophageal that you're really worried about. Mm-hmm. So she also has to be on the ball for knowing when she's likely to get pregnant.
Right.
But it's just, I think you need to discuss all three options mm-hmm. with her because there's no right answer. They're all hard.
Yeah.
They're all hard decisions and they all carry risk.
Right. Clearly a more complex situation that requires some multidisciplinary, but also involving the patient's preference and prior history. So this patient in particular goes on to have radioactive iodine ablation of her thyroid gland, and she develops iatrogenic hypothyroidism as expected. And she is planning to try to become pregnant in the next few months from now. She has started a prenatal vitamin. What recommendation in pregnancy would you have for this patient, and what type of follow-up would she require?
So in terms of thyroid hormone replacement is what you're talking about. Okay. So
In grace.
Okay. So she's got, so there are a couple of things. So one, if she's had her radioactive iodine therapy done, you know, she's hypothyroid, but she still has a history of Graves' disease. So she still may have thyroid receptor antibodies present, which could pose a risk to fetus in terms of passage. So it's important to kind of know what her thyroid receptor antibody is, particularly in the third trimester, because that's the one that's probably most predictive of, you know, risk of needle Graves' disease. Because she's had it ablated, she is not able to increase her thyroid hormone appropriately during pregnancy, because there is an increased thyroid hormone requirement during pregnancy for a number of reasons. You have deiodinases in your placenta, your thyroid binding globulin is higher. So there are reasons why the person needs a bit more thyroid hormone, and baby is very dependent on a mom's thyroid hormone, particularly for the first 12 weeks, particularly for brain development. So, you know, really what we do tell women is, we recommend that they increase their thyroid hormone replacement at least 30%, you know, 2 extra pills per week, probably more actually, depending on the person, if they're completely athyroid, and you really want to follow them carefully. So you're titrating that thyroid hormone to your targets within pregnancy. So which is less than 2.5, more or less, for your first trimester, or less than 3 for your second and third.
Awesome.
Yeah, just a couple of, I agree completely. The other thing is, you know, going into the pregnancy, you want her TSH at that target, so you know what her dose is, and then the extra 2 pills, and then not to take it at the same time as her vitamins because of the calcium and the iron in the prenatal vitamin. They need to be separated so they're not in the stomach at the same time to reduce absorption.
Thank you both so much for this really interesting discussion. Dr. Keeley, can you please summarize some of the main key learning points that we brought up today?
Yeah, so first for the diagnosis of this woman is to not limit your diagnoses too early, and to make sure that you've excluded the ones that would obviously be different from a management point of view. And that secondly, thyroid storm is real and life-threatening, and it is essential to prevent that and to get the PTU and iodine on board prior to anesthetic. The third is PTU is always the choice over methimazole, but methimazole is still a good drug for treating Graves' disease. And I wouldn't reuse PTU in the setting of an adverse event like she had. And then lastly, for any woman who receives radioactive iodine for Graves' disease, she still has Graves' disease. Mm. So she needs her hypothyroidism managed, but she is very different than someone who had de novo hypothyroidism unrelated to radioactive iodine, and that baby is at risk and needs to be monitored in a high-risk situation for neonatal Graves, measuring the TRAB and surveilling the baby.
Thank you both so much.